This is After the Snow, your new favorite podcast, at least for some of you guys who figured it out. The rest of, you know, you'll be coming along soon.
We only want the smart ones.
That's right. I'm your co-host, Dave Mays, and along with me, of course, is my partner, Freeway Rick Ross. What's up, Rick?
Man, I'm good, Dave. How you?
Good, man. Feeling good. Things are moving.
Yes. You know? It's been tough this week, man. I had a long weekend, man. A lot of traveling, as usual. I guess everybody know I'm going to be somewhere in the air. But not this week, though. I'm taking off this week. I'm going to stay home for a couple days.
Okay.
Enjoy L.A., man. It was hot down in Virginia, man. They hot down there, man.
Whew. Oh, I heard the temperatures were close to 100 out there, or 90s?
Over 100. It was over 100 one or two days, man. 106 or something like that there. I mean, and the humidity, you know, like, it's one thing to be hot, but then you'd be sweating and, you know, like sweat dripping off of you. You know, you got to go shower 2-3 times a day.
Well, on that note, I got to talk about the Chicago summertime, because Chicago summer is amazing so far. You can get a little look out the window here at the beautiful sky and skyline. But out this side, when I look out this window, I'm looking at the lake, Lake Michigan. And a lot of people who've never been here don't realize Lake Michigan is like the ocean. Like, you know, that thing.
It's ginormous.
It's huge. It goes forever. It's not like a regular lake. And we have literal beaches, nice sand beaches, just a few blocks from where I'm sitting right now. And you get amazing breeze off the lake. Man, we've had some, you know, some days have been hot, but the evenings have been like amazing. And the city just comes alive in the summertime too. Everybody's out and about. There's so much to do, so many different activities, man. So,
man, I saw you with my folks, man, Gangsta Boo. And
Yes. I wanted to mention that. Yeah, I made it out on Saturday to what they call the C Number picnic. They've been doing that for many years out here. The C Number prisoners, I'm not sure I'm explaining it exactly right, but they're people that were convicted in the 70s and were given these C numbers. And, you know, it made it extremely difficult for them to get paroled, or, you know, the type of, you know, opportunities like that they should have. And so a lot of them have gotten out. But Larry Hoover, I believe, is one of the C number prisoners in the 70s from his original murder case in 73. So there's a lot of really good people that come out to that picnic every year. I've met some people that I hadn't met before. One in particular is the son of David Barksdale. A lot of people may not know David Barksdale, but David Barksdale was the founder in the late 60s here in Chicago of the Devil Disciples. And his group and Larry Hoover's group initially were kind of rivals. Larry Hoover had the Supreme Gangsters and David had the Devil Disciples. They ended up coming together and joining forces to form the Gangster Disciples in the early 70s. And David Barksdale, unfortunately, died in 74, shortly after they had formed their partnership. It was King Larry and King David. And so, you know, it's really important to the history of you know, street organizations in this city and the divide between the BDs and the GDs that you still hear going on to this day. A lot of people trace it back to, you know, around that time of David Barksdale's death. So his son was there. Little D, I got a chance to meet him, and he's going to get involved with the podcast story that we're working on for Larry Hoover. So that'll be really, really important to get his.
And that podcast going to be off the chains, man. I can't wait.
Yeah, man.
You know, I love Larry's story anyway. You know, out of all American gangsters, excluding myself, you know, I like Larry's the best, man. I was intrigued by his story. And not only because, you know, I was in jail with quite a few dudes that, that was in his organization. You know, I was on the same basketball team as Poteet, who was a lieutenant. And like, you know, Bible and me studied in the law library every day. So I had a chance to read their paperwork and you know, look at their case. And it was very, very intriguing to me. So I love that story. I want to hear more. I want to know more, you know, about what took place.
Yeah. I mean, people really don't know or appreciate, you know, I think the depth and importance of what he evolved into with growth and development in the 80s and 90s and the whole political movement that he established, and his whole plan to help reshape urban communities. I think, you know, things would be very different had he been allowed to continue with the movement that he had been building. And most of that information is just nowhere to be found. People only, you know, they've painted him into such a narrow box, you know, for years and years. The media, the police and law enforcement and prosecutors putting out, you know, one thing after another after another. And they've muzzled him all these years. You know, once they put him in the feds out there in the supermax, like, he can't talk to nobody, can't do interviews, he can't get his words out because they censor him or threaten him. You know, it's
that brings up, you know, that brings up another thing. You know, right now we got this feud going on between WAC 100 and Jay Prince over this footage that this lady filmed when they were allowing journalists to still go inside of the prisons. I don't know if you heard about that, but it's a feud going on. It's been going on over the internet for quite some time right now.
Yes.
And that's because, you know, after 9/11, they stopped allowing federal prisoners to do interviews. I'm lucky that all my stuff hit the fan before 9/11 happened, because had it wouldn't, you know, all the interviews that I was able to do, 60 Minutes, 2020, and all those, Nightline, and, you know, all the interviews I did, I probably wouldn't have been allowed to do them. It would have been very hard. It probably would have took something like a presidential letter or something to get those interviews, because now you used to have the freedom of speech, and that meant that any time that you had a way to get your message out, you were allowed to do that. But after 9/11, they took that away from inmates, you know, where now you're not allowed to speak to the media. It used to be mandatory that if a news person came and they could show their credentials that they was work for a legitimate news company, they were allowed to come in and interview you. You know, I can only imagine now, you know, what stories. I mean, even I probably wouldn't have the footage from my documentary. You know, in my documentary, Jesse Katz came down and interviewed me, and he recorded the conversation. Well, if I was now, he wouldn't allow, you know, they wouldn't allow Jesse Katz to get that information. So, and I think that's something for them to actually be able to silence our inmates, you know, because the First Amendment right was given so that we could talk about the injustices or things that's going wrong in the prisons or things that need fixing. You know, now a person could get beat up in prison by the police and nobody would never know because they're not allowed to talk to the media.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's definitely a big issue among others, you know, in terms of just the way, you know, Black men in particular are perceived. You know, the idea of redemption, I think, is something that America doesn't really embrace, particularly when it comes to Black folks and Black men in particular. You know, we've been projected this imagery for so many years of the negativity and kind of brainwashing people to where, like, people don't understand that there's, you know, so many incredible people that are incarcerated. We all, you know, make mistakes in life, and we're all in different circumstances, so those mistakes, you know, can lead to different outcomes. But at the end of the day, there's some brilliant people such as yourself and others who have been incarcerated, and, you know, it shouldn't be thought of like, you know, these people can't change and they're, you know, can't contribute anything, that type of thing.
That's a good point, Dave, because, you know, like one of the things that I noticed from doing my time, that over time my life kept changing. You know, every couple of years my mentality would change to something different. You know, sometimes I would be angry, you know, at the system for keeping me so long. And then I would say, shouldn't it be a time where if a person developed into a certain level of consciousness, shouldn't there be some type of a test or some type of evaluation where sensible people, not these people who they got on parole boards now, these people are definitely insensitive. You know, remind me of my OPO. You know, this guy was definitely insensitive to me. I had an opportunity to go speak at Harvard University, but since they called me and wanted me to show up within 3 days, and normally it takes 2 weeks to get approval, he said no. And I'm saying, well, how could you deprive a person of what, in my case, I felt was an opportunity of a lifetime, you know, to get to speak at one of the most prestigious colleges in the country. But that's the way our system is set up. You know, there's no, like you said, no redemption.
Yeah. I mean, the criminal justice system in America is just, I mean, it's rotten to the core, all levels of it, you know, I would say. So, you know, it needs a complete overhaul. You know, like our police departments do. So with that being said, before we get to, I still want to hear a little bit about what you did, but I want to mention one other thing I think would be interesting just to bring up. So I created an organization 2 years ago in 2020 with a good friend and colleague of mine, Bakari Katwana. Bakari is a very accomplished editor, author, writer, public speaker, activist, and he worked with me at The Source in the 1990s for, you know, many years, did some incredible work there and has done all this other great stuff. But we started something called the Hip Hop Political Education Summit. And this is an organization that we want to, you know, educate the hip hop community of all races and generations, you know, on the political process and how we can use hip hop as a culture to help create change in our communities. And so we did a couple of virtual summits with some amazing speakers, different artists from Bun B and M1 from Dead Prez. And I mean, it's a long list of artists, and Cornel West and Michael Eric Dyson and Senator Cory Booker, all these different people participated. And we're doing another one that we're going to announce soon that's going to take place in September. And one of the kind of focuses this time around is, you know, we all, you know, everybody got out the vote in 2020 to elect Biden and get Trump out of office. But the reality is, you know, all these promises that were made of things that were going to happen, nothing's gotten done, you know, which, you know, some of us know is par for the course with this political system that we've had. But it's like, where does that leave us? Because, you know, the voting, there is power in voting, particularly if we can get organized and we have the right leadership, you know, involved. But it's also, you know, the question of why vote if nothing's going to change, and how do we deal with this reality? So that's going to be part of the focus of this summit, different discussions we're going to have about that. And, you know, Larry Hoover was very much focused around voting. And in this day and age where voter suppression is so, you know, prominent and being recognized finally, you know, I just thought it was, you know, it was a timely thing to mention. And since we were talking about all that stuff, and see what your take is.
Yeah, definitely let me know. I would love to go there. You're absolutely correct. But it's so much to these politics, man. You know, one of the things I watch on TV is CNN. And what I've known is they talk some about this filibuster. You know, even if you have the numbers in Congress and the Senate, you still can't pass any laws because of the filibuster. So I don't totally understand that all that together, but I'm definitely with going to a summit to anything to better myself. But I tell all my friends, it don't matter who in the White House, my kids still got to eat. So, you know, I still got to come up with ways to maneuver, even under the worst situations that may pop up. So,
Sorry, Rick, I was looking at something. Somebody is missing their schedule and they're hitting me in the middle of my podcast. So I apologize to you and everybody else, but, let's get back to, you know, to tell us quickly about your week. I know you were in Virginia, you mentioned, but you were like in a deep part of Virginia, in a very historic part of Virginia. So I want folks to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, we were down in what they call Lynchburg, and this is the country of Willie Lynch. You know, I don't know if people heard about Willie Lynch, but Willie Lynch came up with a formula of how to train a slave, you know. And how to separate slaves. And it was crazy that that I was in that town, and then I had to do a speech at the club that night. So, you know, I kind of lightly touched on how that teaching had separated Black people and caused the division that we still have today, you know, where he taught the field workers not to trust the house, and the house ones not to trust the light ones, and the light ones not to trust the dark ones, and just to have that separation. And we talked about basically in my speech about how important it is for us all to start working together and lending a hand, even if there's no money in it for yourself. You know, one of my things that I've learned, if you build it, the people will come. And the only way you can build it is by working. You know, one of my saying is that, the only place that success comes before work is in the dictionary. So we got to keep working. I left Virginia and went to Mississippi, man. So I was in the thick of it. I was in Marinia, Mississippi. One of my friends bought a resort down there with a golf course on it. And
nice.
Yeah, we're gonna try to lay that out, you know.
What's your golf game like? You got any?
I never golfed before, man.
Me neither. We got to take some lessons.
Now we got a reason to golf now, man.
Yeah.
I had to invite you down. We go down and just hang out and hit some balls, man, and relax.
So yeah.
That was pretty much my weekend, man. Been really, really busy. You know, things are looking good on the boxing tip. And think I got the money to finish my marijuana grow.
So nice.
Excited about that. You know, met a couple of hedge fund guys that say that they can put the money where we need it. And,
great.
And get moving forward, man.
That's what's up. So
I got a meeting today. You know, when I leave today after this meeting, I'm going downtown to City Hall about giving me my license so I can open up my dispensary. You know, I haven't opened my dispensary yet. I've been having my license for 2 years and the city hasn't given me my permit to open my doors. You know, I'm like, come on, man, let me open my doors. Let me sell some weed.
Please. I hope that gets moving. You know?
So you ready to get into the snowfall, man?
Yeah, let's talk about it. We you know, it's a brand new season. We wrapped up episode 10 episodes of season one last week, and now we're jumping into season two. Starts off, they say, like, 4 months after the last season has ended. Just to kind of recap the end of season one, Teddy killed his man Alejandro. He got with the Colombians directly now, and he's getting encouragement from the government to keep doing what he's doing. So he's figuring out his new operation at the end of season one. Also, and Lucia make the big move where they kill her uncle, align with the guy Stomper and his gang. And that's a big, you know, turn of events at the end of season one. They kill Lenny Franklin and the guys kill Lenny, so they kind of get in the clear of any outstanding beef, and the money's rolling in, and that's kind of where season one ends. Franklin's mom is kind of upset, though. She's found out to some extent what he's doing, and the shooting of Leon shook her up. So that's going to be definitely something we'll watch in season two. So I got some thoughts, but let me hear, what was your initial take on season two, episode one, Sight Lines?
Well, you know, with the raid at Avi's house, definitely was the highlight of the show, you know, with Franklin wind up getting away and Leon going to jail, and Avi's in jail as well. You know, that was very interesting, kind of, you know, and I felt that maybe they took a little bit from my story, you know, because I talk about in my book, not where we got raided, but when Ivan gets shot, there was a period of time that I didn't have anybody I can get drugs from because I didn't know nobody else. So they kind of go through a little similar talk. Theirs was through a raid, you know, where Ivy goes to prison. But that was interesting to me. Where else do we go from there?
Just on that, that's interesting. So you said, who was it that got shot, and you had to deal with a supply issue?
My guy, Ivan.
Okay.
Yeah, his wife had said, called him cheating and shot him in the back and paralyzed him. So he was in the hospital for about 9 months. You know, he was in Los Alamitos. I'm looking for him all over, right? I can't find him, but he's in the hospital. And so one day, I guess he mustered up the strength, you know, to be able to call me.
So was this before you met Danilo?
Yeah, this was before I met Danilo. Had Ivan, when I was working with Ivan was really, I almost had the game to myself during that time. I mean, I was making money hand over fist, you know, like uncompeted, you know, no competition at all money. You know, I could do whatever I wanted to do. When he got shot, those 9 months, some people called up. You know, even though I still had some nice gaps, though. You know, when I started dealing with Danilo, was after Ivan had mustered up the strength, you know, to get back in touch with me. Ivan tried to run the business from a wheelchair and from his bed, but it was a too tough. And then his brother-in-law wind up selling Danilo to me.
So, yeah, we see Franklin is kind of scrambling in this episode once the raid happens. And they're like, well, damn, you know, we're selling this stuff like hotcakes. And now where the hell are we going to get it from? Everybody's trying to figure out some type of connect. And the last idea, right before the end, is Franklin says, we're going to drive up to Oakland. We're going to go see that guy, the RZA, who turned them on to the crack cocaine last season. And we're going to see if we can get some product from him and supply from there. But so how did you handle that before you heard from Ivan? What were you able to do?
We start running around the city looking for stuff. And during that time, I wind up buying $80,000 worth of cake mix. You know, the guy came in to the house. You know, we had one of those Scarface moments. I got my guys out there. I got two guys sitting out in the car, you know, watching the door. And then I got my, I think I had two guys, I think me, Tone Tone, and somebody else might have been in the house. And I had the money, and the guy walks in the door with a bag. And I said, give me the stuff. And he said, give me the money.
Yeah, that sounds like Scarface.
Yeah, so I said, let me see the stuff. He said, let me see the money. So my dude, who was one of Ivan's friends, and I thought that he ran like a little clothing store, you know, where he sold clothes and stuff like that, like a sweatshop. And I felt good about him because, you know, I'd done business in his shop a couple times with Ivan. So he grabbed the money out of my hand and went to the door and gave it to dude. So when he did that, dude dropped the bag and took off out the door. So I ran over, grabbed a bag and looked at it. I said, man, this ain't no dope. So I run out the door after him. He have a car sitting outside. He jump in the car, take off. My guys smoking weed or something. I don't know what they doing, but they slipping on their pimping. So I jump in the car. Come on, man. We chasing the dude. We chasing him through the city.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he running red lights and all kinds. So he wind up getting away. But my guys who were sitting in the car, they ran in and grabbed Tony. So when I finished chasing dude, I get with them. They got Tony at one of our spots. I get there. They done whooped Tony up. Tony head all knotted up, bloody. And I said, hold up, man. Y'all slow down. They about to kill Tony. I said, no, don't kill Tony, man. I don't think he had nothing to do with it. You know, I couldn't see him allowing somebody to grab the money and leave him sitting there with us. You know, I just, it didn't sit right with me. So I took Tony home, you know, and told him I was sorry what happened. And he said, I'm going to pay you back. I'm going to get your money. So he take me to the guy's house that he do, the dude had packed up and left to Puerto Rico or somewhere. Man, he was out the country.
Oh, wow.
And then when I got back with Ivan had heard the whole story, and he's like, yeah, that guy took off on you, man. But yeah, that was just one incident that happened to me, man. I got beat out of about $80,000. I should have took that. I didn't even make a cake with that cake mix.
Could have made a lot of cakes with that.
I should have took it and sold it.
Oh, now speaking of cakes and snacks, another thing they show at the beginning of this episode, they show the guys at the house, you know, cooking it up and packaging it, and they're putting it in potato chip bags and Frito bags and stapling them up. And then I guess they're selling the crack in the potato chip bags off the ice cream truck.
Yeah. That's, I mean, it was too fast for all that. I mean, the police wasn't fucking with nobody. You didn't have no reason to hide it, you know? And in the beginning, Dave, the neighbors didn't care. See, our neighbors used to let us sell crack. It was only after it started getting out of control, you know, like guys would come by shooting and
right,
you know, fighting and, you know, just it got the gang element got into it. You know, first it wasn't, you know, when I got in, Dave, I was a young dude to get in. I got in at 19. So I was dealing with dudes who was like 35, 40, 50 years old. You know, they was like, you know, they was players.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I did is I allowed younger dudes to get involved. You know, I started bringing in dudes 16, 17, 14. And then, you know, it just got to a point to where anybody could get involved. You know, we had systems set up to where you could elevate your game on your own. You really didn't need no whole lot of money. You know, $50, $100, you was in the game.
Got it.
So, you know, everybody started getting in.
So no potato chip bags or ice cream trucks.
It took too much time, you know what I'm saying, to do it. Dave, the way we had it, you walk on the street, you can have a half a key, a quarter key of cocaine, and it might be gone in 15 minutes.
Wow.
You didn't have no time to be looking for no potato chip bags. Listen, we would go to the supermarket, and we would buy all the baking soda they had. My guys didn't like going to the supermarket buying baking soda, because people be looking at you crazy, like, what the fuck they doing with all that baking soda?
Right.
You would come out the supermarket with a whole shopping bag cart full of baking soda.
Wow.
So Under Armour was involved too. Co-conspirators. Under Armour was co-conspirators, baby.
Yeah, they had to be.
I bet they knew what was going on. You know, right. Under Armour knew what was all that baking soda was going, man. So that was definitely you know, some make-believe stuff for somebody who definitely wasn't in the streets.
Got it. Yeah. So what else happens on this episode? D-Ray makes his debut. You know, he's a new character in this season. Our boy D-Ray Davis, aka Peaches. That was nice to see.
Oh yeah, with the attempted robbery.
Yeah. Yeah, yes. D-Ray took two guys out, man.
Yeah, yeah, that was, it happened so quick, you know, it really wasn't a whole lot to that, you know, no planning, no schemes, just, you know, two people tried to break in the house. I didn't really get much out of it, you know. One of the things that we did learn is that Franklin said they gotta dig holes, that digging take a long time. So he let us know that he had dug a hole before and buried the body in that scene. So
that's true.
Yeah. That was, you know, kind of catchy. What else?
It was the one of the bail bondsman dudes and his brother that tried to rob them. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh yeah. I remember now. Yeah, because they was talking about that Franklin didn't want him to know how much money he had.
Right.
And he was at the bail bondsman. But yeah. At that time, he's talking about they only had $40,000, so it ain't like they got a whole lot of money. You know, right. Franklin mentioned that they have 40 G's, so they didn't have no whole lot of money. It ain't like they was, you know, had no millions at that time.
right.
But I guess 40 G's was enough to go and rob them for it.
So I think another interesting thing I thought about with this episode was with Teddy. I mean, it was kind of like they were very heavy on the political spin. The thing opens up with Ronald Reagan's speech, and you know, this is, we gotta preserve freedom in Central America, and this is the most important thing to keep the Soviets out of there, and you know, if we win this war, we can change the course of history, and all the hype about, you know, this Nicaragua, you know, war and the U.S. involvement in that. But what we learn is this is the point where the funding gets cut by Congress, and his CIA contact, his boss, calls him and basically says, look, it's all on you. You got to come up with $21 million a year or whatever. But there's no more direct connect between you and anything official from the CIA. Even me and you, you know, can't have any direct connections anymore. So this is where they kind of play into this idea, I think, that came out with, you know, around Danilo and all that stuff, that, you know, the CIA had no knowledge.
Definitely, this one here definitely tinkered on my story a lot. You know, even like you said, from the start with Ronald Reagan, I mean, this is all Nicaraguan Contra. This is all my stuff. My case is the only case that ever been tied to this whole scenario that they're talking about in this story. So,
right.
At the very least, they took that from my story.
Well, we know they took a lot more than that.
We do. But so, I'm just saying, at the very least, you know, that this is obvious parts of mine.
What else? Let's talk, I guess, last about Lucia and Oso, because they're making some moves now. They're getting their product from Teddy. They're involved, I guess, in helping Teddy's new distribution, where they have people in Mexico.
Did you see how they hooked up with Teddy?
Yeah, I mean, they had been hooked up with Teddy, right? I think they had already started dealing with Teddy last season.
I didn't remember seeing, and that was interesting to me. How did they hook up with Teddy? Because I'm still tripping off how Teddy and Franklin just hook up. You know, Teddy runs into his car and
right,
knocks him out, and he kidnaps him, and
right.
You know, that's interesting to see the next show how, you know, how this relationship builds from there. Like, motherfucker, you know, right, run into my car and me, and now you talking about you want me to buy some dope from you? You know. Yeah. Where we do it is we went and tell a motherfucker, we're going to pay you to introduce me to that dude, man. You know, take me to your leader. I'm going to give you $60,000 to take me to the leader.
Right, right. So,
you know, running the car doors and knocking people out and all that, you know.
That was wild. Yeah, that was that.
I guess. And I don't remember him meeting Lucia and them in Oso. You know, I've been waiting on that, the introduction, you know, like how did... Right. How did this relationship come about?
Well, where was Lucia getting the cocaine from? Where were they getting it from last season?
I don't remember where they got it from. I don't think they ever showed us where they were getting it from. Did they? I don't remember that.
I'm not sure. But the other thing that I was also a little questioning was, you know, Lucia has the crack rock in a little baggie she's carrying around, and she's got samples of it. And I'm trying to figure out, when did they get turned on to the crack rock? Because I think last season they were just dealing with the powder coke and bringing it to Stomper. That was their whole thing with Stomper, was the powder coke connection. But they didn't know about the crack. So I don't know how she came up on this crack rock, and how do they know how to even make it at this point? And then they make the decision, we're not going to fuck with Stomper. We're going to go to this other Mexican cartel, I guess, and we're going to deal with them, because I guess they feel like they'll make more money with the crack with them. And, you know, they don't want to bring that to Stomper. So that was kind of, you know, a bold, you know, move there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they leave a lot of loose ends, I believe, in telling the story. But you know, we'll see where they go with it. You know, I'd be lost sometimes with some of the moves, you know, they don't pan out to make good common sense.
So yeah, it ends. Teddy, like you said, kidnaps Franklin. We'll see where that goes. And Pedro shows up, Lucia's cousin. He's got a beard and mustache. I guess he's been out of the picture for these 4 months. Now he pops back up. You know, they done killed his dad 4 months ago. So who knows what that's all about. I guess we'll have to wait next week and see what happens.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Last thing that's in the news this week that is kind of related to, since, you know, we're talking obviously a lot about crack and the impact of crack. Have you heard about the new Showtime documentary on the Supreme team out of Queens, New York?
No, I didn't hear about it.
Okay. Yeah. Nas basically directed and produced this 3-part docuseries. It's on Showtime. You know about Kenneth Supreme McGriff?
Absolutely.
Sure. So he had the Supreme team in Queens in the 80s, and they were, you know, heavily involved.
I was in jail with a couple of them.
Okay.
Yeah, I know some of the Supreme team.
Okay.
I knew Prince. I knew Prince very well.
Well, Prince is actually the central part of this documentary. They have a long series of conversations that they recorded with him, I guess, over the phone from prison. So he's kind of narrating and telling his story. From what I've seen so far, I haven't got, you know, very far into it yet. They did have Supreme's voice on there, but so far only a little bit. It's mostly been Prince. I think he was the main impetus behind how they put this documentary together. But yeah, maybe check it out, or we'll both finish watching it and talk a little bit about it.
Definitely. You know, Prince was my guy up there. He was at Lompoc with me for the 18 months I stayed in Lompoc. Me and him, I got to be pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It was a couple more guys on the Supreme team that was there, but Prince was the most visible and probably the most vocal on the yard. So I would definitely watch that, knowing that he had something to do with it.
Yeah. Where's Lompoc?
Northern California.
Okay.
Right on the coast.
And they had him all the way out in California.
Yeah, well, you know, when some guys, if Prince is one of those guys, you know, he carries a lot of weight in the pen, and they tend to put them in areas where they don't have as much influence. You know, they figure if he was on the East Coast, he would have too much influence.
Yeah.
So they move him to the West Coast, where his influence is not as strong.
I get it.
Because, you know, Lompoc was a Crip and Blood yard, you know, and Southsiders, you know, those were the gangs that really weighs the most power. And so they would want Prince to be out here, because if he was in New York, you know, his strength would be too strong.
Got it.
Because he was strong in Lompoc.
Hmm.
Yeah, Prince a rider.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely check it out. Check it out. We'll talk about it maybe next week. So let's wrap up. I mean, it's another good, you know, episode, another good conversation with you, Rick. You know, glad we get to do this every week.
I've been hearing about that Funny Marco, man. They said that Funny Marco is crazy. I gotta go online and watch it right now.
We probably having the single biggest viral moment for Breakbeat yet, literally this morning and last night when we dropped the Orlando Brown Funny Marco clip. And man, everybody's sharing it, all the major platforms everywhere. People are talking about it. So it's great. Yeah. Shout out to Marco, man. He's an incredible talent and he's doing his thing and this is just the start. Yeah. All right.
You end it here.
All right. We'll see y'all next week. After the snow, Dave Mays, Freeway Rick Ross. You know how we do. Peace.